This is disc number 13.
The Dharan army is not far from the palace, Nathan said. They will soon have to face Jagang's horde. I think you're right that I would best help our cause if I were there. Nikki hadn't told any of them yet. She cleared her throat to make sure that her voice would not fail her. Richard spoke to the army. That's why he went to Dahara. He told them that they could not fight the Imperial Order and hope to win. Anne's face went crimson. So what does he expect them to do? If not fight the army of the Order, then what? Lay waste to the old world, Nikki said with grim resolve. Zed, Nathan, and Anne stared silently at her. He told them to do what? Zed asked incredulously. It's the only way, Nikki said. We have no hope of destroying their army. Richard intends the Dharan army to instead destroy their will to fight. It's the only chance we have. Dear spirits, Zed whispered as he turned away. He went to the window and stood staring out into the night. He finally turned back, his eyes brimming with tears. I have been in his position. I have had to direct our side to do things that had to be done. He shook his head again. The poor boy. I'm afraid he's right. I should have seen it myself. I guess I didn't want to. Sometimes it takes lonely courage to do what must be done. Kara stepped forward and went to one knee before Nathan. She bowed her head. Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Zed dropped to one knee, as did Rika. Nikki did the same. Finally, reluctantly, Anne followed. Master Rawl, guide us, they all said in unison. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light, we thrive. In your mercy, we are sheltered. In your wisdom, we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Nathan stood tall and silent, hands clasped, looking down at the bowed heads, looking very much like the Lord Rawl. When they had finished the devotion, they all stood, somewhat disquieted by the unspoken significance of what they had just done, of what it meant, that Richard was no longer the Lord Rawl. It is done, Kara said. She tested the feel of her slender red weapon in her fingers, gazing at it with liquid blue eyes. My Ajeel is alive again. She smiled in a distant, sad way. The link of the bond is whole once more. All Daharans will recognize it and know that we again have a Lord Rawl. Nathan let out a deep breath. At least we have that on our side. Nathan, Zed said to the Prophet, you must get to Dahara at once. There are Imperial Order troops at the larger passes east of here into Dahara, still trying to find a way in the back door. I will show you some ways around them. It would be best to have a Lord Rawl, the guardian of the bond, standing with those now standing alone at the palace. What about Jagang's army? Anne asked, looking concerned after Nathan nodded his agreement. What do you think Jagang will do once he discovers that the Dharan army has evaporated right before he could close his fist around them? Zed shrugged. He will lay siege to the people's palace. Verna and some of her sisters will be there to help defend the place. But the people's palace is built in the form of a spell that amplifies the power of a Rawl and suppresses it in others. Verna and the sisters will not be able to wield the full force of their ability. Right now, Nathan is the only Rawl we have to help defend the palace and its people. That's why we need Nathan to leave at once for the palace, Nikki said. Tonight, Zed added. Nathan's gaze moved from Zed's eyes to Nikki's. I understand. I will do my best. Let us hope that Richard will one day be able to take his place back from me. At that moment, his words lifted at least a little of the weight from Nikki's heart. We will be working on that, Zed assured him. You can count on it, Nikki said. Kara pointed her ajeel at the prophet. And you had better not get any crazy notion in your head that you will be keeping the post. It belongs to Lord Rawl. Nathan arched an eyebrow. I am the Lord Rawl now. Kara made a sour face. You know what I mean. Nathan smiled a slow smile. Anne jabbed Nathan in the ribs with a finger. And don't you get any grand ideas, Lord Rawl. I'm going with you to make sure you stay out of trouble. Nathan shrugged. I guess that the Lord Rawl could use an attendant. You'll do. Chapter 35. After lying on the ancient cold stone floor in the depths of a lonely forest for what seemed like an eternity, staring down into the black abyss, not knowing what else to do, Richard finally sat back up. He had called to the Slith until he was nearly hoarse, but there was no answer. The Slith was gone. Richard put his elbows on his knees. As his head sank, he clasped his hands behind his neck. He felt like he had lost his way and didn't know what to do next. How many times since he'd left his Heartland woods had he felt just this way? Had he thought that he was at the end of his rope? He'd always found a way. He didn't know if this time he could. As he was growing up, Richard had never known that he had been born with the gift. He'd never known anything at all about magic. Once he discovered that he'd been born with a gift, he didn't want it. He wanted only to be rid of it, as if it was a sickness that had been passed down to him. He just wanted to be himself. But he had finally come to accept the value of his abilities and understand that they were part of who he was. They had on many occasions, after all, helped him save not only his own life, but Kaelin's and many others along the way. His gift was a part of him, something that couldn't be separated from him any more than his heart or lungs could be. Now, though, he'd somehow lost the gift. At first, when the Slith had told him that he no longer had the magic required to travel, he'd had a hard time believing that such a thing was possible, that his gift could really be gone. He'd thought it must be a magical malfunction, an anomaly of some sort. Back when he'd wanted to be rid of it, he had inquired as to how he could shed his gift, and had learned that such a thing simply wasn't possible. While it didn't seem conceivable to him, Richard knew that it was true. He knew because along with his gift, he had lost his ability to remember the Book of Counted Shadows. He might as well have never memorized it because, along with his gift, that memory was suddenly lost. The Book of Counted Shadows had been a book of magic. The gift was required to be able to read it, and required to remember even so much as a single word of the text. Without the gift, Richard couldn't read books of magic, or, more accurately, recall the words long enough to know that there had been anything there to read. Without the gift, books of magic appeared blank. Now his memory of the Book of Counted Shadows had gone dark. And now, he had failed a test he hadn't even known he was taking. He wasn't even at all clear as to what the test had been. Somehow, though, he had failed it. He felt as if he had failed Kaelin. He couldn't imagine how those words could have been a test from Barakas. How could they possibly test him? Test him at what? He didn't know what test the Slith could be talking about, so he had no way to figure out how he had failed it. He wished he had Zed to help him figure it out, or Nikki, or Nathan. Someone, anyone. He stopped and asked himself how many times that night he had wished for answers, for help, for salvation to come save him. None of the wishes had been answered. Wishes, he knew, never were. He reminded himself that he was wasting valuable time feeling sorry for himself. He had to think, not sit around hoping that someone else would come along and think for him. He lay back on the stone and stared up at the canopy of limbs and leaves above, and beyond them, the stars. He smiled, mocking himself, thinking that maybe a falling star would answer his wishes. He pushed aside the thoughts of wishes and put his mind to the task at hand. He'd run the whole thing through his mind 100 times, and it still made no sense. Baraka said, through the message left with the sliff, that he didn't have the answers that would save Richard. Baracus believed, though, that Richard had within him what was needed to succeed. Baracus told Richard to believe in himself, and wanted him to know that he believed in Richard, although he hadn't used Richard's name specifically. The message, Richard reasoned, had been meant for the one who would be born with the subtractive side of the gift that Baracus had seen to it was released from the Temple of the Winds. But Baracus didn't know that person's name, didn't know specifically who that person would be. At least, Richard didn't think he did. It made more sense that Baracus simply spoke directly, personally, without using names. The message had been clear enough without having to use the name of the person who would eventually hear it. That gave it the sound of a direct address. How could that be a test? How could Richard fail it? He sighed in frustration as he pulled a long stalk of grass growing from one of the missing mortar joints off to the side. As he considered the issue, he flattened the soft base of the stalk of grass with his front teeth. Could it be that the sliff somehow had been given some power by Baracus, like the power he'd given her to act in an emergency, so that she could see whether or not Richard had what it took to succeed? Could it be that this insight given the sliff told her that Richard fell short in some way? The source. As he stared up at the stars, Richard mulled that over in his mind. He'd told the sliff that he had heard those words before from Shota, and then, all of a sudden, the sliff had been done with him. Could the sliff know Shota? Maybe, in Baracus's view, Richard should not be associating with a witch woman. Maybe that was the reason Richard had failed. Because he hadn't been doing things on his own, by himself. He made a face. He had difficulty imagining that Baracus wouldn't want him to work with people, to find answers, to solve problems. He ran the words over in his mind, as best as he could recall them anyway. I am sorry. I don't know the answers that would save you. If I did, please believe that I would give them eagerly. But I know the good in you. I believe in you. I do know that you have within you what you must to succeed. There will be times when you doubt yourself. Do not give up. Remember then that I believe in you, that I know you can accomplish what you must. You are a rare person. Believe in yourself. Know that I believe you are the one who can do it. That was what the sliff had said was the message from Baracus. Richard recalled, though, that those had been the same words Shota had told him not very long ago, the last time he had seen her, just before she left. Richard didn't really believe in coincidence. In this case, he certainly didn't. Shota could not have said by chance the same words that Baracus had told the sliff to say. The message was too long and too detailed, with characteristics that were far too idiosyncratic. If that was the case, that it had not been coincidence, and Richard was sure it wasn't, then why would Shota have used the exact same words that Baracus had? Was it a message of some kind? Was she trying to tell him something? Warn him about something? If the witch woman had wanted to help him, then why didn't she warn him about the test and tell him? If not the answer, then she could at least have told him what the test would be. Zed had often said, though, that a witch woman never told you what you wanted to know without telling you something you didn't. Could that be it? He doubted it, since she had told him a great many terrible things that day. Things, it turned out, that had helped him finally grasp what he had to do with the army, rather than allowing them to fight Jagang in a final battle. The thing that was itching at him, though, was that there were phrases in the message that were unique. Answers that would save you. Give them eagerly. Know the good in you. You have within you what you must to succeed. Know that I believe you are the one. Those were all slightly uncommon patterns in the way people spoke. They were not drastically different, but they were a bit eccentric, almost childlike, and yet rather formal in a simplistic way. Richard sighed. Couldn't seem to put his finger on it, but there was something distinctly unconventional in the use of language within that message. With an icy shock of realization, he remembered. He remembered why those words had sounded unsettlingly familiar when Shota had said them. It was because he had heard those exact words before. Those were the exact words that had been spoken by the Night Wisp the evening of the first day Richard had met Kaelin. They had been in the Wayward Pine. Kaelin asked if he was afraid of magic, and then, after approving of his answer, she brought out a little striped bottle that held the wisp. The Night Wisp, Shar, had guided Kaelin across the boundary, but by then it was dying. The wisp was unable to live away from its home place and those of its kind. It didn't have enough strength to cross the boundary again. Richard remembered Kaelin saying, "Shar has sacrificed her life to help me, because if Darkenrall succeeds, all her kind, among others, will perish." The wisp had been the one who told Richard for the first time that Darkenrall was after him. Shar had warned that if Richard ran, he would be caught and killed. Richard had thanked the wisp for helping Kaelin. He told Shar that his life had been made longer because she had saved him from doing something foolish that day. He told Shar that his life was better for knowing her, and thanked the wisp for helping bring her safely through the boundary. Shar had then told him that she believed in him, and the rest of it, exactly as Barakas had related through the sliff. At the time he had thought that the slightly odd speech characteristics were simply idiosyncratic of wisps, and perhaps they really were, but Barakas had used those exact words for a reason. Shota had used the same words, too, either deliberately or innocently unaware of their source, no doubt in order to help him by reminding him of those words from Shar. She probably didn't realize the real reason for saying those exact words, but through her ability they were intended to make him think, to make him remember. It was probably only because of the terrible vision Richard had had of Kaelin witnessing his execution that he hadn't connected Shota's words with the same words he'd heard years before from the Night Wisp. That vision had simply overpowered everything else. Richard listened to the night sounds off in the woods, the bugs chirping, the leaves rustling in the wind, and a distant mockingbird, as another memory began seeping back into his consciousness. Shar, the wisp, had used his name without being introduced. He supposed that the wisp could simply have overheard it while in the little bottle in the pouch at Kaelin's belt. Or she might have already known his name. Richard's eyes were opened as wide as they could go as he recalled something else. He had asked the wisp why Darkenrall was trying to kill him, if it was because he helped Kaelin or if there was another reason. Shar had come close and asked, "Other reason? Secrets? Secrets?" Richard jumped to his feet and cried out aloud with the shock of understanding. He pressed his wrists to the sides of his head, unable to suppress another shout. "I understand! Dear spirits, I understand!" Secrets. Richard had thought at the time that the wisp knew about the tooth that Richard kept hidden under his shirt, but that wasn't it at all. It had nothing to do with that tooth. Shar was asking him something entirely different. She was offering him his first chance at recovering the secret book Barakas had left for him. But it had been too soon. Richard hadn't yet been ready. Richard had failed Barakas's test back then, too. Failed it for the first time that night with the wisp. Barakas, though, probably had no way to know when Richard would be ready. He had to have a way to test him from time to time. Shota had said that just because Barakas had seen to it that Richard had been born with the ability, that didn't mean he would do the right things. Barakas hadn't taken his free will, and so, from time to time, Barakas needed to test the one born with that ability, to see if he had learned to use it to accomplish those things along the way that needed to be accomplished. Richard wondered how many other things put in his path had been the doing of Barakas. At the moment, he had no way to know the answer to that question. He did know that when the sliff said he failed the test, that was at least the second time he had failed it. The sliff's test was a reserve test, a repeat test, for after Richard had learned more, after he'd had a chance to know who he really was. Secrets. Richard felt as if his head might explode with the power of comprehension. Every emotion he had ever had seemed to collide together, twisting his insides with the excitement and anxiety of it all. He threw himself down on the stone floor, hands gripping the edge until his knuckles were white. Sliff! Come back! I know what Baracus meant! I understand! Sliff! Mere inches away, liquid metal rose up into the cold, silvery moonlight, forming into the flawless features of the Sliff. It was an impossibly beautiful vision, reflecting the swaying trees and his own face in flowing distortions of reality. The Sliff slowly smiled. "Do you wish to change your answer, Master?" Richard wanted to kiss the quicksilver face. "Yes." The Sliff cocked her head to one side. "What is it you wish to confide in me, Master?"
"A Night Wisp told me that before, not just Shota." Richard gestured with the frustration of trying to get it all out at once before the Sliff could say that he had not passed the test. "Shota was the second. It was a Night Wisp who first told me those same words, the words Baracus used. That's where I heard it first. That's what Baracus wanted me to know, that it's the Night Wisps." Richard half expected silver arms to slip around his neck and draw him closer.
"Anything else, Master?" the Sliff whispered intimately.
"Yes. With that message, Baracus wanted me to realize that what he left for me alone, is hidden with the Night Wisps."
The Sliff came closer yet, still showing the gentle curve of a knowing smile. Her gaze drank him in. For the first time ever, her lips moved with her words, her voice coming in the breathy whisper of surrender. "You have passed the test, Master. I am pleased."
"Now there's a first," Richard said.
The Sliff laughed, a sound as clear and pleasant as the moonlight. "Do you know the place of the Wisps, Master?"
Richard shook his head. "No, but Kaelin told me a little about them, about their home place. Kaelin is my wife. She has traveled in you before and was pleased. But you don't remember her because she was captured by some very bad people who released a spell to make everyone forget her. Something a little like what was done to you. I'm trying to find her before those same bad people can hurt everyone. That's what this is all about. That's why Baracus left something for me. Something to help me in my efforts."
"I see. I am happy for you, Master."
"Anyway, Kaelin told me about the place where the Night Wisps live. She said that it's beautiful."
"So Baracus told me, too."
"Kaelin said that you can't see the Wisps in the daytime, only at night. I guess that's why they're called Night Wisps. Kaelin said they're like stars fallen from the sky. She said that it's like seeing stars among the grass."
The Sliff nodded at his excitement. "I am happy that you are pleased, Master."
"Can you go there, to the place of the Night Wisps, this place of stars fallen to the ground?"
"Even if you could travel, I'm afraid not," the Sliff said. "Baracus directed that this emergency portal be built here for a reason. He did not want me to be able to go to the home place of the Night Wisps because he did not want anyone to know that he went there. He did not want it to become a destination either, but rather to remain a remote and secret place of stars fallen to the ground. Baracus told me that this portal is not a great distance from the Wisps, but it is the closest I can get to them. He did not want me to give any hint that this place existed, or to ever divulge anything involving my future masters. It was his way of protecting you. That is why I could not tell your friends where you were. That secrecy and security was also meant to be part of what would bring forth the right words from the right person. That protection not only protected you, but denying you the help of your friends prompted you into thinking for yourself. Thinking is what Baracus said would turn the key for you." Richard's head spun with everything he was learning. He leaned closer, seeking to confirm what he already knew. "You brought Baracus's wife, Magda, here, didn't you? And she was carrying something with her."
Yes. This is the place I brought Magda after the last time I saw Master Barakus. She repaired the stone here before going back. That was the last time I saw her. No one has been through to this place ever since then. You have passed the test, Master. This is the way to the secret library Barakus left for you.
Chapter 36. Kaelin stepped carefully among the rubble of ancient buildings that had over the millennia crumbled and eventually toppled, sending sections tumbling down the steep hillside. Dusty pieces of brick and stone lay scattered everywhere among the dry, decomposing dirt of the slope. It would be easy to stumble and fall in the dark, and it was a long way down. Jillian, a shadowy, lithe shape just ahead of them, climbed the scrabble as effortlessly as a mountain goat. Sister Ulysia, ahead of Kaelin, and the other two sisters behind her, huffed and puffed with the effort of the arduous ascent. As eager as they were to press on, the sisters were getting tired. They frequently lost their footing and slipped, nearly falling from the bluff. Kaelin thought that they would be well advised to wait until daylight to finish climbing up into the ruins of the city of Casca. She wasn't about to give them that advice, though. The sisters did what the sisters wanted to do, and there was nothing Kaelin could do about it. In the end, the only result of any suggestion she might offer would be a beating for interfering. Kaelin would have been happy to see any one of the sisters fall and break her neck, but she knew that the other two would be no less trouble than all three. For that matter, one of the sisters was more than capable of making Kaelin's life a torturous nightmare. Any of them could easily use her power through the iron collar around Kaelin's neck to put her in a state of unendurable agony. So she climbed without commenting on the wisdom of doing such a thing by the light of the moon alone. Since Jillian's trail was so treacherous, they'd had to leave the horses at the base of the headlands. There were certain items, though, that the sisters would not let out of their sight, much less leave behind, and so Kaelin was made to carry them, along with what other pack she could lift. It was a grueling effort to lug the heavy load up the precipitous trail. Jillian had wanted to help with some of the packs, but the sisters refused to allow it, saying that Kaelin was a slave and meant for a slave's work. They told Jillian to worry about guiding them to Tovi. Kaelin signaled Jillian with her eyes to do as the sisters wanted, and move out. She silently reminded herself that such work would only make her stronger, while the sisters, shunning any effort, would only grow weaker. Kaelin wanted to remain strong. Someday she was going to need her strength. But it had been a long day, and that strength was flagging. At least they were nearing the end of the lengthy, headlong journey. Soon enough the sisters would all be reunited, and then maybe they would settle in for a time, be a little less tense, a little slower to anger. While Kaelin looked forward to a respite of a day or two, she was troubled by what it would mean. The sisters had given the clear impression that this was to be the end of the journey, the end of their struggle, and the beginning of a new era. Kaelin could not imagine what that could mean, but it worried her greatly. The sisters often talked among themselves of the reward that awaited them, being nearly in their grasp. More than once, Sister Ulysia had remarked in answer to the other's impatience that it won't be long now. Kaelin had no idea what their plan was, what great event was about to take place, but she was certain that it involved the boxes she carried on her back, Lord Rawl's boxes. The two sisters following behind kept a careful watch on those boxes. The night before, Kaelin had overheard the sisters say that when they reached Tovi and the third box, the preparations would begin. Kaelin sighed in relief when they at last reached the top of the steep incline, finding themselves standing at the base of a decomposing wall. In places, gullies had undermined and washed out sections of the wall. Kaelin took one last look out over the moonlit plain far below before following Jillian through one of the dark gaps in the wall. Once into the breach, in under the wall still remaining overhead, Kaelin discovered that the wall was as thick as a small house. Whatever people built such a wall must have been decidedly worried about what might come to attack them. The steep trail leveled out on the other side of the wall and led them among buildings set close together. Many places near to the edge had crumbled,
or were leaning and about to fall. The massive wall had held much of the decaying rubble back, but in places parts of falling buildings had gone over the top. Over time, broken bricks, blocks, and mortar had also been washed down through the gullies. They soon found themselves on a narrow street among buildings that were in better shape. The outer fringe of structures had seemed to take the brunt of the weather, and as a result were the most deteriorated. From the confinement of buildings, they made their way out into a graveyard. In the moonlight, it was a haunting sight. Statues stood here and there like phantoms among the dead. Making their way among the graves, Kalin saw that higher up, the buildings lay like an endless carpet over the rolling landscape. In the clear sky she spotted Jillian's raven, Loki. The girl had never pointed it out, apparently hoping the sisters would think it just a wild bird. But when Kalin would glance her way, Jillian would sometimes signal with her eyes to look up. Loki would do aerial tricks that would make Jillian, if the sisters were looking the other way, smile. She seemed a girl searching for some small reason for joy among the desolation of what had befallen her and her grandfather because of the sisters. When Sister Armina once noticed the raven, she thought that it was a vulture following them across the desolate landscape. Kalin didn't correct her. "How much farther?" Sister Alicia asked as she paused among the grave markers. For some reason, Kalin thought that she sounded suspicious of Jillian. Jillian pointed. "Not far. Up there, through that building. It's the passageway to the dead." Sister Cecilia snorted. "Passageway to the dead. Toby always did have quite the sense of drama." Sister Armina shrugged. "Seems pretty appropriate to me." "Go on, then," Sister Alicia said as she gestured for the girl to get moving again. Jillian started out at once, leading them out of the maze of the graveyard and up into the empty city. Kalin couldn't tell for sure by the light of the moon alone, but it seemed that everything, every wall, roof, street, every part of everything, was the same color of dust and death. The ghostly silence in among the buildings shrouded the night with an eerie sense of stillness. Kalin felt as if she were walking through the immense skeleton of a city, as if every bit of tissue and life had been stripped away, and all that was left was crumbling beige bones. Along a broad thoroughfare that, by the look of the decorative curving stone walls to each side, must once have been beautiful, Jillian slipped like a shadow through the arches fronting one of the larger buildings. Inside it was hard to see. Kalin heard the girl's feet crunching across bits of crumbled mortar. The sisters didn't seem to notice the mosaic underfoot. Where moonlight fell across the floor, Kalin could see faded little tiles that made up a picture of trees, paths, and a wall surrounding a graveyard. There were even mosaic people. Looking at the sweep of the picture across the floor, as she lugged her heavy load, Kalin tripped on a missing section of tile and fell to her knees. Sister Alicia immediately struck her across the back of her head, knocking Kalin sprawling on her face. "Get up, you clumsy ox!" Sister Alicia shouted as she kicked Kalin in the ribs. Kalin was trying, but with the weight of the load on her back it was easier said than done. "Yes, sister," she said, gasping between the kicks, hoping to gain time to stand. Jillian stepped between them. "Leave her be!" Sister Alicia straightened with a glower. "How dare you interfere? I'll wring your scrawny neck." "I think we ought to skin her alive," Sister Armina said, "and leave her bleeding corpse out there for the vultures." Sister Alicia snatched Jillian's collar. "Get out of the way so I can teach this lazy ox a lesson." "Leave her be," Jillian repeated, refusing to back down. "Let's just cut the little brat's throat and be done with her," Sister Cecilia complained. "We don't have time for this. We can find Toby on our own now." Knowing that she had to pacify the sisters before they carried out their threats to harm the girl, Kalin finally managed to regain her feet. She immediately took Jillian's arm and pulled her back out of harm's way. "I'm sorry, it's my fault," Kalin said. "We can go now." Kalin half-turned to start out, but she didn't take a step. She knew better than to do so without permission. Sister Alicia didn't move. She had murder in her eyes. "Not until she sees you get the kind of lesson we've owed you for quite a while now," she said. You're getting far too used to being treated lightly at your every transgression.
You will leave Kaelin be,
Jillian said from halfway behind Kaelin, trying not to be pushed any farther into the background. Sister Ulysia planted her fists on her hips.
Or what?
Or I'll not show you where Tovey is.
You foolish child, Sister Ulysia growled.
We already know where Tovey is. She's in here. You've already led us to her. Jillian slowly shook her head.
There are miles of passageways down there. You'll get yourselves lost among the bones. You leave Kaelin be, or I'll not show you the way.
I consent, Tovey, Sister Cecilia said with a dismissive sigh. Cut the girl's throat. We're close enough that I can find Tovey now, with my gift alone.
I too consent, sir, Sister Armina said. Sensing that she is near, Jillian said, doesn't mean that you will be able to find the correct passageway to get to her. Down there, down with the bones, you may be only a short distance from her, but if you take one wrong turn among many you must make, you will go for miles and never reach her. People have gone down there and died because they couldn't find their way back out.
Sister Ulysia clasped her hands, considering, as she peered down her nose at the girl. We don't have time for this right now, she finally announced. Get going, she told Jillian. She turned a meaningful look on the other two sisters. Soon enough we will even this score, along with others. She turned back with a menacing expression that widened Jillian's eyes. You get us to Tovey, or she's liable to get impatient and start breaking your grandfather's bones. One at a time.
Jillian's face registered sudden alarm. She immediately led them into a labyrinth of passages and rooms through the back of the building. There were places where the passageways were open to the moonlight. In other places it was cramped and black as death. The sisters lit small flames that hovered above their palms so that they could see. Jillian looked startled to learn that the women could do such a thing. They emerged from the building into another graveyard. Without slowing, Jillian led them through the place of the dead, among hillocks covered with gnarled olive trees and rows of graves mottled with wildflowers. She finally brought them to a halt above a gravestone standing on its side beside a black hole in the ground.
Down this rat hole? Sister Armina asked.
If you want to get to Tovey, Jillian grabbed a lantern from beside the coverstone, and after a sister lit it, started down. They all funneled into the narrow stairway, following Jillian down. The ancient stone steps were irregular, with their leading edges rounded over and worn smooth. For Kaelin, with all the weight she was carrying on her back, the descent was treacherous. The sisters held out wavering flames to help them see. At landings they all turned with the stairs and continued ever deeper into the realm of graves. When they finally reached the bottom, the passage opened into wider corridors that were carved from the solid but soft rock of the ground itself. All around were niches carved in the rock walls. Kaelin noticed that all those recesses held bones.
Watch your heads, Jillian said over her shoulder as she went through one of the doorways to the side. They all ducked as they went through after her into a room with a ceiling just as low as the doorway. At intersections, Jillian took turns without any hesitation, as if she were following a trail painted on the floor. Kaelin noticed that there were a few footprints in the dust, but she also saw footprints going off down many of the different corridors. The prints were bigger than would have been made by the girl's small feet. The cramped corridor finally opened into larger chambers. They passed through seemingly endless rooms stacked with orderly piles of bones. Other narrow rooms were lined with niches stacked full of bones, as if they had begun to run out of places to put all the dead. There was a series of several rooms filled only with skulls. Kaelin estimated that there had to be thousands of them. They had all been carefully fitted together into large niches, each skull facing out. Each niche was filled right up to the top. Kaelin gazed at all the hollow eyes staring back at her, watching her pass. She reminded herself that these things had once been people. They all had once been alive. Each had once been a living, breathing, thinking individual. They had once lived lives filled with fears and longings.
It reminded her of how precious and brief life was, how important it was, because once it was gone, for that person, it was gone for good. It reminded her yet again of why she wanted her life back. With Jillian, Kaylin felt that she now had a link back to the world, to who she was. When Jillian saw and remembered her, Kaylin felt just a little more alive, as if she really was somebody, and her life had meaning. They passed through rooms with leg bones stacked in their own niches, arm bones in yet others. Long stone bins carved at the base of the side walls lined some of the rooms. These bins held smaller bones, all laid in neatly. Separating the bones of skeletons in such a way seemed to Kaylin a strange thing to do. She thought that surely it would be more respectful of the dead to leave the bones of the deceased together. It was possible, she supposed, that they didn't have the luxury of space, since stacking them this way did save a great deal of space. Maybe it was simply too much work to carve a niche for just one body, or one family, when there were so many dead to bury. Maybe there had been a great sickness that claimed a large portion of the population, and they couldn't be burdened with such niceties. The city within the walls looked pretty cramped. Space must have been at a premium. If the people and their dead were to remain within the walls of the city, the living would have had to make concessions. It seemed an odd problem, since the land around the city is stretched empty from horizon to horizon. She wondered if it could have been a time of war, when sentimental considerations for the dead had to be abandoned in favor of the needs of the living. The headland did seem the most defensible place around. While parts of the walls were at the edge of the sheer bluffs, they could always have enlarged the city farther back on the headland. She supposed that it could be that expanding such massive city walls was considered too difficult. She wondered if it could be, too, that the people who had once lived here simply didn't have the same sentiment for the dead that other peoples did. After all, what real significance was there in bones? The life was gone from them. The individual they once had been was no more. It was life, after all, that really mattered. Their world had ended with their death. But the people here must have had an attachment to these bones, to the people they had been, considering how difficult it would have been to construct such an underground city for the dead. Kayla noticed, too, the faded, carefully drawn and carved decorations around the niches. No, those alive cared. They mourned for those who had died. She wondered if, when she died, anyone would remember who she had been, or even know that this person, Kaylin, once had lived, had loved life. She felt an odd jealousy for all these bones. Friends and family of each set of bones down in this place had known the person they had been, grieved for them, and put these talismans of that valued individual to rest in a way that the living would remember those who had passed. Kaylin wondered what had happened to all the people who had lived in this place, to the people who buried these bones. She wondered who had buried them. After all, the empty buildings bore silent testament that no one was left, except Jillian. From what Kaylin had learned, Jillian lived with a small band of nomadic people who came to this place from time to time. They abruptly arrived at a section of the passageway that looked like it had partially collapsed, leaving the floor strewn with rubble. Sister Amina snatched the girl's arm. "This tour of the catacombs is getting ridiculous. You had better not be leading us on some silly roundabout lark." Jillian lifted an arm to point. "But we're almost there. Come on and you'll see." "All right," Ulysses said. "Get on with it then." Jillian stepped around a huge slab of stone that looked like it might have once sealed what was beyond. There were gouges on the floor where it had been slid aside to clear the passageway and allow access to what lay beyond. When Jillian went in, Kaylin could see that her lantern lit a chamber beyond with shelves carved from the solid rock. The shelves were all loaded with books. The colors of the leather spines were faded, but they looked to once have been mostly an assortment of rich reds and deep blues, with the rest being a variety of other colors from pale green to gold. The sisters marveled as they gazed at all the books,
They were suddenly in good spirits. Sister Armina let out a low whistle as she slowed to peer around at the shelves. Sister Cecilia laughed out loud. Even Sister Alicia smiled as she ran her fingers over the dusty spines. "This way," Gillian said to move them along. They happily followed the girl as she went through a series of rooms, mostly small and cramped, with shelves all stuffed full of books. Gillian wound her way through a warren of passageways carved through the soft rock, taking them ever deeper into the underground library. The sisters' heads swiveled, seemingly lost in reading what titles they could make out as they shuffled along behind Gillian and Kaelin. The light of the lantern fell into dark rooms they passed, revealing yet more books.
"Curse the light,"
Sister Alicia whispered to herself in delight. "We have found the central site in Casca. This is the place where the book will be. I bet that Tovey has been spending her time searching for it." "I bet she's already found it," Sister Cecilia said, excitement animating her voice. Sister Alicia grinned. "I have a feeling you're right." Through a more finely carved, barrel-ceilinged hallway adorned with a vineyard mural that had long ago faded to a ghost of what it once had been, they rounded a corner and arrived at a set of double doors. The two doors, carved with simple designs of grape vines and leaves, were each narrow enough that they could easily have been one wide door. Kaelin supposed that the two doors made the entrance a little grander, for some reason. "I sense Tovey beyond, at last," Sister Cecilia said with a sigh of relief. "I think we should start the rituals tonight," Sister Armina said in a bubbly voice. Sister Alicia nodded as she laid a hand on the bronze lever. "If Tovey has managed to find the book, and I bet that by now she has, then with the three boxes finally back together, I don't see why it can't begin at once." She smiled distantly. "The sooner the Keeper is freed from his prison, the sooner we will have our reward." Kaelin wondered if there was any way she could ruin their plans. She was sure that once they accomplished whatever it was they intended to do, there would be no going back, for anyone. She considered the boxes she was carrying, and wondered what would happen if, when the sisters were distracted with finally seeing Tovey again, she were to smash at least one of the boxes. She might even have time to smash both. Kaelin knew that such an act would do more than incur the full wrath of the sisters. She expected that they would probably kill her. But then, Kaelin had come to believe that if the sisters succeeded, she would be as good as dead anyway. Sister Armina leaned in. "And as our first act, I think we should settle an old score." Her expression turned venomous. "I remember all too well being sent to the tents by that arrogant brute. I'll never forget what his soldiers were allowed to do to us." Sister Alicia's brow drew down with a murderous glare. "Oh, I think that is one score we will all relish settling." A baleful smile spread through the glare. She twisted the bronze lever. "Let's get on with it." Chapter 37 Sister Alicia threw open the doors and marched into the pitch-black room beyond. "Tovey? What are you doing in the dark? Sleeping?" Annoyance took control of her tone. "Wake up! It's us! We finally made it here!" With the sisters in the lead, carrying small flames above their upturned palms, there was just enough light to make out nearby torches in brackets on the walls to each side, but not much else. The sisters sent those small flames into the cold torches, igniting them with a hot whoosh. As the torches flared to life, light flooded a room that wasn't very large, with bookshelves carved into the straw-colored rock of the walls. On the other side of the small room sat a heavy iron and plank table. In the tall, decoratively carved chair behind the table sat a burly man, his chin resting on a thumb as he watched them. He was the fiercest-looking man Kaelin had ever seen. The three sisters froze in mid-stride. Their eyes opened wide, reflecting their confused,
disbelieving shock at what they were seeing before them. The powerfully built man sat calmly behind the table, watching the three sisters. That he didn't speak, didn't move, didn't seem to be in the least bit of a hurry, only increased the palpable sense of danger in the room. The only sound was the hissing torches. The man, with massive muscled arms and a bull neck, was the embodiment of pure menace. Without a shirt, his brawny shoulders bulged from a lambskin vest that lay opened in the middle, displaying his naked, powerful chest. Silver bands encircled his arms above bulky biceps. Each of his thick fingers bore a gold or silver ring, as if brazenly proclaiming them plunder rather than decoration. His shaved head reflected glimmers of the fluttering torchlight. Kaelin couldn't imagine him with hair. It would have diminished his intimidating presence. A gold ring in his left nostril held one end of a thin gold chain that ran to another ring at mid-height in his left ear. He was clean-shaven except for a 2-inch braid of mustache growing downward from the corners of his smirk, and another braid in the center under his lower lip. As frightening, as formidable, as remorseless as the man looked, it was his eyes that were the true nightmare. There were no whites to them at all. Instead, they were clouded over with sullen, dusky shapes that shifted in a field of inky obscurity. Even so, there was no doubt whatsoever in Kaelin's mind when his gaze settled on her. That gaze made her feel naked. She thought her knees might buckle under the weight of her galloping panic. When his grim gaze moved to the sisters, Kaelin reached out blindly, finding Jillian, and pulled her protectively under an arm. She could feel the girl trembling. Kaelin noticed, though, that Jillian didn't seem surprised to find the man in the room. Kaelin couldn't understand the sisters' silence, or their inaction. By the overt look of threat presented by the man, she expected that they would have incinerated him by now, just to be on the safe side. The sisters had never before been the least bit shy about killing anyone they even suspected might be trouble. The man was clearly far more than trouble. He looked capable of crushing their skulls in his fist. The look in his eyes said that he was used to seeing such deeds done. Behind Kaelin, two burly men stepped out of the dark corners and closed the double doors. They, too, were fierce-looking, with wild tattoos and menacing swirls over their features. Their massive muscles were sweat-slicked and sooty, as if they never washed off the smoke of oily fires. As they stepped together before the closed doors, Kaelin could smell their sour sweat through the stench of the burning pitch. These two looked more than ready for any eventuality. Heavy studded leather straps holding a variety of knives crisscrossed their chests. Axes and flanged maces hanging on their weapons belts glinted in the light of the hissing torches. Their faces were also studded with metal spikes, in their ears, eyebrows, and through the bridges of their noses. It almost appeared that they had hammered nails through parts of their faces. They, too, were shaved bald. The two men didn't look entirely human, much less civilized, but rather a deliberate corruption of the notion of mankind, embracing instead steel, soot, and elements of a beast. Even though they carried short swords, they didn't draw them. They didn't appear the least little bit afraid of the sisters. Emperor Jagang. Sister Ulysses' watery, weak voice trailed off in abject terror. Emperor Jagang. The shock of those two words jolted Kaelin down to her soul. There was something about her concept of this man, formed from seeing his army from a distance and from having been through some of the places they had attacked, that made Kaelin fear him even more than the sisters. In contrast to the sisters, masculinity added an alien dimension to the nature of the threat he projected. For as far back as she could remember, they had done everything possible to stay away from Jagang, and yet here he sat, right in front of them. He looked relaxed, like a man who had everything well in hand. He appeared to have no worries, Not even Sisters of the Dark appeared to concern him. Kaelin knew that this was no accidental encounter. It had been staged. More than Kaelin's fear of Jagang engendered by the sisters' overheard conversations and their dogged avoidance of the man, there was something else, something deeper, a dark dread rooted in her very soul, almost like a memory beyond her reach, betrayed only by its indistinct but sinister shadow. When Kaelin stole a glance to the side, she saw that the sisters appeared frozen in place, as if they had been turned to stone. They had also gone ashen. Sister Alicia was wearing her blue dress, chosen especially for the reunion with Tovey. It was now dusty not only from the climb up onto the headland, but from the descent down into the interior of it. Sister Armina wore a dress with white ruffles at the wrists and at the low neckline. Under the circumstances, in a dusty grave and standing before leering brutes, the ruffles looked naively ridiculous. Sister Cecilia, older, tightly controlled, and habitually tidy with curly gray hair, now looked on the ragged rim of a leap into the refuge of madness. Jagang's sullen eyes watched the three sisters. He was savoring the moment, Kaelin knew, savoring their startled horror. If the sisters had been able to do anything about the situation, Kaelin was sure that they would already have done it. Sister Armina's tongue darted out to moisten her lips. "Excellency," she said in a small, strained voice. Kaelin thought it a pitiful attempt at a respectful greeting, conspicuously born of panic, not respect. "Excellency," Sister Cecilia added in a voice no more steady. Kaelin had on rare occasions seen the sisters cautious, even wary, but she had never seen them afraid. She had never even been able to imagine them being frightened. They had always seemed in utter and complete control. Now their habitual haughty dispositions were nowhere in evidence. All three sisters bowed in halting movements, like three puppets on strings. When she straightened, Sister Alicia swallowed in trembling terror. As frightened as she obviously was, confused curiosity, as well as the unendurable silence, drove her to speak. "Excellency, what are you doing here?" Jagang's treacherous glare again melted into a smirk at the gentle, innocent, feminine tone of her question. "Alicia, Alicia, Alicia," he sighed heavily. "You really are one monumentally stupid bitch." All three women went to a knee as if they had been slammed down by an invisible fist. Small, whining whimpers escaped their throats. "Please, Excellency, we meant no—"
"I know exactly what you meant. I know every last dirty little detail of everything in your minds."
Kaelin had never seen Sister Alicia cowed, much less so badly shaken. "Excellency, I don't understand—"
"Of course you don't,"
he said with a sneer as her words dwindled away to silence.
"That is why you are on your knees before me, and not the other way around, which is just what you were wishing, isn't it, Armina?"
When his gaze slid to Sister Armina, she let out a small, startled cry. Blood oozed from her ears, running in a little red trail down the snow-white flesh of her neck. Other than her slight trembling, she didn't move. Jillian's arms clutched at Kaelin. Kaelin put a hand protectively to the side of the girl's face, pressing her close, trying to comfort her when there was no real comfort to be had before such a man. "You also have Tovey, then?" Sister Alicia asked, still so surprised by the turn of events that she couldn't come to grips with it.
"Tovey!" Jagang burst into a fit of gruff laughter. "Tovey! Why, Tovey has been dead for ages!"
Sister Alicia stared in horror. "She's dead." He lifted his arm with a dismissive wave.
"Finally sent to the afterlife by a mutual friend, a very unfaithful and traitorous friend. I imagine that the Keeper of the Underworld is quite angry with Tovey's failure in her service to him. You will have all of eternity to find out just how angry."
His smirk returned as he glared at the woman.
"But not until I am finished with you in this life."
Sister Alicia bowed her head.
Of course, Excellency. Kalin noticed that Sister Armina had wet herself. Sister Cecilia looked like she was ready to collapse into tears. Or screams. Excellency, Sister Alicia ventured, how could you? I mean, with our bond.
Your bond!
Jigang roared with laughter again, slapping the table.
Ah, yes! Your bond to Lord Rawl! Your touching loyalty to Lord Rawl that protects you from my talents as a dreamwalker.
Kalin's heart sank to hear that the sisters were in some kind of alliance with Lord Rawl. For some reason she had thought more of the man. It hurt to find she was wrong.
We're not the ones attacking Richard Rawl,
he said in a falsetto voice, clasping his hands in a mocking manner, apparently quoting some statement from Ulysses' past.
Jigang is the one going after him, seeking to destroy him, not us. We are the ones who will wield the power of Orden, and then we will grant Richard Rawl what only we will have the power to grant. That is enough to preserve our bond and protect us from the Dreamwalker.
He lost the effeminate pretense. Your loyalty and devotion to Lord Rawl is touching. His fist slammed down on the table. His face went red with rage.
Do you stupid bitches actually believe that such a bond to Lord Rawl as you dreamed up would hold you free of harm?
Kalin remembered the sisters talking about the same thing, and she hadn't been able to understand it back then, either. Why would Richard Rawl have anything to do with these evil women, much less enter into a pact with them? Could such a thing really be true? Could it be that he was really no better than they? One thing about it all didn't seem to make any sense, though. If they were sworn to him, then why would they steal the boxes from his palace? But the bond's magic... Sister Ulysses' voice trailed off into silence. Jigang stood, a move that made the three gasp and tremble all the more. Kalin was sure that, had they been able to, they would have backed up at least a step, and likely more. He shook his head, as if he could not believe that they could be so ignorant as not to understand. Ulysses, I was there in your mind watching the whole sorry event. I was there the day, years ago, that you proposed the scheme to Richard Rawl. I have to tell you, I didn't really believe that you were serious. I had difficulty believing that you could be so stupid as to believe that you could strike such a bargain to gain your freedom from me.
But it should have worked.
No, there was no way such a thing could work. It was nothing more than an irrational idea. You wanted to believe it was true, so you did.
You were in our minds that day? Sister Cecilia asked. Why would you allow us to believe we had succeeded?
His inky gaze fixed on her.
Don't you remember what I told you all in the very beginning? On the first day you stood before me. Control, I told you, is more important than killing. I told you then that I could have killed you, but what good would you be to me then? As long as you're under my dominion, you're no threat to me. And of use in, oh, so many ways. No, of course you don't remember, because you chose instead to think that you were smart enough to trick me with your convoluted, illogical notion of the bond. You think you are too clever to be outwitted. And so here you stand before me again, never having left my dominion.
And yet you just let us go about our business? Sister Cecilia asked.
Jigang shrugged as he stepped around the table. I could have stopped you at any moment if I chose. I knew I had you under my thumb. But what would I have had to gain, then? Just a few more Sisters of the Dark, and I already had plenty of those. Although their numbers are seriously diminished by now.
He leaned down toward them with an aside. Your kind has a tendency to do a lot of dying on the behalf of the cause of the Fellowship of Order.
But with you, Jigang said as he straightened, I had something highly interesting. I had Sisters of the Dark who were up to things.
He tapped a thick finger to his temple. Who had devious plans and the knowledge to pursue them.
You have a lifetime of experience from the vaults at the Palace of the Prophets, vaults holding thousands of books that are now gone. No matter how irrational your plans sometimes become, witness your present condition, that does not negate your reserve of knowledge gained through decades of study, or mean that every one of your plans was unworkable. So you knew our plans all along, from that day with Richard Rawl?
Jagang glared at Sister Ulysia.
Of course I knew! I knew your plan the instant you concocted it!
His voice lowered with menace. You thought I only came into people's dreams. I don't. You thought I wasn't there, in your mind, when you were awake. I was. Once I enter into your mind, Ulysia, I am there in your mind always. Whatever you think, whenever you think it, I witness it. Every dirty little thing you conceive, I see. Every thought, every action, every vile wish, I know as if it were spoken aloud the instant you conceive it. Because I wasn't making you aware of my presence, though, you ignorantly believed I wasn't there. But I was. He waggled a thick finger.
Oh, Ulysia, I was there.
When you told Richard Rawl your plan, that you wanted to swear loyalty to him in exchange for someone he cared deeply about, well, I could hardly believe that you just assumed it would work.
For some reason, Kaelin felt a pang of sadness to hear that Richard Rawl had someone he cared deeply about. She guessed that ever since that day she had been in his beautiful garden, she had come to feel a connection to him on some deeply personal level, even if it was only a shared appreciation for the beauty of growing things, an appreciation of nature, and thus the world around them, the world of life. But now she was hearing that he was dealing with Sisters of the Dark, and that he had someone he cared deeply about. It made her feel all the more like a forgotten nobody. She wondered what she could have been thinking.
But, Sister Ulysia stammered. It worked.
Jagang shook his head. Fidelity on your terms, fidelity even though you would continue to work for his destruction, even though you would continue to work for everything he stands against, fidelity even though you would continue to be sworn to the Keeper of the Underworld, fidelity concocted of your selected selfish wishes is just that. Wishes. Wishing doesn't turn your desires into reality just because you want it to.
Kaelin felt at least a small level of relief to hear that the sisters were continuing to work for Lord Rawl's destruction. Maybe that meant that he wasn't really an ally of the sisters. Maybe, in some way, he was like her, being used against his will.
I could hardly believe it as I listened to you dictating the terms of your loyalty to him, Jagang was saying, gesturing in a grand fashion, claiming that such fidelity was subject to the moral filter you, not he, would apply.
I mean, if you were going to contrive beliefs out of thin air, Ulysia, why didn't you just save yourself some trouble and decide that by sheer willpower alone your mind had been rendered impenetrable to a dreamwalker? That would have been just as effective a shield.
He shook his head.
My, Ulysia. How cruel of the nature of existence not to allow you your irrational desires.
He swept an arm out.
And just as amazing, the rest of your sisters believed it too. I know I was there in their minds as well, watching as they were overcome with glee that they were to be free of my ability. Just because you claimed you could tap into the bond to the Lord Rawl with your own form of loyalty.
But you allowed us to do it, Sister Ulysia said, still overwhelmed with astonishment. Why would you not strike us down then?
Jagang shrugged. I had plenty of sisters under my thumb. This was an interesting opportunity. I learn a great deal from the knowledge others possess. Learning things gives one power one would not otherwise have. I decided to see just what you could accomplish if left to your own devices. See what you could learn for me. After all, I could have dropped any of you at any time if I grew weary of my little experiment. There were times when I was greatly tempted, such as the time not long ago when Armina said,
I'd love to string Jagang up and have my way with him.
He arched an eyebrow. Remember that, Armina? Not to worry if it has slipped your mind. I will be reminding you of it from time to time, just to refresh your memory.
Sister Armina lifted a hand, as if in supplication. I was only...
He glared at her until she fell silent, unable to conjure an excuse, and then went on.
Yes, I was there all along. Yes, I saw everything. Yes, I could have struck you down at any time. But I have something you don't have, Ulysia.
I have patience. With patience, you can move mountains. Or go around them. Or climb over them.
But you could have had Richard Rawl right there, when we offered him our terms. Or you could have had him at his camp. You could have had him at camp as well. You spelled him and had him down. You could have ended it. Then why didn't you? Because you had a grander plan. So you left him be, thinking that your bond to him was your protection, while you went on to pursue something of greater worth to you.
But you didn't need him, she pressed. You could have taken him.
Ah, but while killing people as punishment is useful, it's not nearly as beneficial as what you can do with them when they are alive. Take you three, for example. Death brings no great punishment, only the reward of the afterlife if you have served the Creator in this one. You three, however, will be denied the Creator's light. What use is that to me? But if a person is alive, I can make them suffer.
He leaned closer. Don't you agree?
This is the end of disc number 13. Please continue listening on disc number 14.